Hello, I'm Yavar Marathi, and welcome back to Odyssey Interviews. I'm joined today by Bruce Kimmel of Kritzerland Records, a label which has brought us so many wonderful film music releases over the years, including 4 Goldsmith titles. But Bruce, I first want to thank you in particular for continuing to champion the fantastic music of Alfred Newman. You just released another Newman score in a new remastering, and I'm really looking forward to hearing that.
Well, you're very welcome.
I can't wait to see what else you've got coming up.
Well, there's stuff. We're trying to do as much Fox stuff as we can, but it's very slow going. You know, they do all these isolated scores, and so...
Yeah, they seem to come out faster. So is that because of Nick Redman working on the Twilight Time stuff?
Yes, and Mike is very busy with that stuff, so... You know, he does all those John Williams things, so we get them out as quickly as we can. We have a very big set that's coming in January or February. I'm told, don't get excited yet. But.
I'm still excited anyway. It's too late. So are you saying that's an Alfred Newman set?
I'm saying Alfred Newman will be part of that set.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I would like to ask you how your relationship with film music began in general. Can you recall what it was like, however old you were, when you first kind of got awoken to the magic of film music?
I can tell you exactly, because I'm old. It was 1954, and I went to a movie called The High and the Mighty. I was taken to that movie in Westwood, and life-changing experience. I thought, well, I saw the movie about 20 times. I made people take me back and back and back. And that score by Dmitri Tiomkin, I remember, I was like four or five. And I stayed to make sure I knew the name of the guy who wrote the music, because I thought the music was amazing. And my father, who owned a great steakhouse in L.A., near downtown, had jukeboxes in several bars he also owned. So I would get the cast off 78s and then 45s. And one of the first ones I got was a 78 of The High and the Mighty on Choral Records, conducted by the composer, Dmitri. And so I played that to death. I had it on 45. So that was the start of it, really. And then I started at that age to take notice of who the composers were when I loved music. So right away in 1956, I remember staying a second time to see The Man Who Knew Too Much, to see who that guy was. And that was Bernard Herrmann, of course. And so always after that, that's what I would do. I would have to know the name, and then I would run out to our local record store and see if there was a 45 or an album, and there frequently was not.
In fact, for those 2 scores you've mentioned so far, there still hasn't been an official release of the film recordings, I believe.
I know.
That must be frustrating. You've been waiting a long time.
I've tried, we've all tried, I guess, to get through to the Wayne Estate about High and the Mighty, what a release that would be, you know, but who knows what they have. I don't think they know what they have, so.
Ever since Stylotone came out with Twisted Nerve, I've been wondering if they would continue with other releases, maybe from the Universal Vaults, and I was thinking maybe The Man Who Knew Too Much might survive in those, but nothing so far.
It's hard to know what their deal is. I probably think they did not do that well with Twisted Nerve. And, you know, the fact is there is a better sounding element than they used on Twisted Nerve, which is irritating because I have it and so do several others.
But they've got the rights tied up.
But they have the rights tied up. You know, it was originally going to be on Entrada. I don't think there's any secret about that.
I didn't know that about Twisted Nerve. I knew Entrada was working on Marnie.
Marnie, and I think they had, well, maybe not Twisted Nerve, but I know they had Marnie. And, you know, we've all had our beautiful copy of Marnie in stereo for many years, but, you know, where is it?
Yeah, I hope that can all get cleared up someday and the rest of us can enjoy it too. So do you recall when you first heard the name Jerry Goldsmith? And if it's a different answer, what work of his first made you fall in love with his music?
It's probably accurate to say that it would have been The Twilight Zone. I don't know if he had any episodes in 59 or not. Did he do episodes the first season? I just don't remember.
He started in 1960. We recently covered his first work. Actually, technically, he wrote and composed his first score in 1959, and that episode aired on January 1st, 1960.
Wow. So that would have probably I'm looking at his list of stuff here. So
right, that'd be The Four of Us Are Dying.
It has to be either that or Thriller. I would have taken notice with those shows because I loved his scores for both of those shows.
So you weren't a George Montgomery fan back then who just had to see Black Patch in theater?
No, I did not see that. And I saw everything. So it's odd that I didn't see City of Fear or Black Patch or Face of the Fugitive or any of those. I saw none of those. Sort of starting with Dr. Kildare, I became a huge fan because that theme was, still is, one of my favorite themes ever written.
It's definitely memorable and became his first hit through no intention of his own.
Stars Will Shine Tonight. I sang it over and over again.
Three stars will shine tonight. One for the lonely. That star will shine its light each time that someone sighs. Stars for all to see, one for young lovers. That star was made to be the sparkle in their eyes. And for the third star, only one reason. A star you can wish on to make dreams come true.
So, professionally speaking, what was the first time you got involved with Goldsmith or a release of his music?
Oh my God. Islands in the Stream.
Right. I remember you were responsible for saving the tapes on that, and Film Score Monthly thanked you on their release of the score.
Yes, I guess they lost the tapes. We were going to do it I was getting Verez a lot of titles in the late 70s and early 80s, and I had gotten them in at Warner Brothers and gotten a little romance for them. And
in fact, you got them into soundtracks in the first place, I believe.
Yeah, their first album, soundtrack album, was for my movie, the first Nudie musical, and they've been trying to live that down ever since, but they cannot, as the Gershwins say, they can't take that away from me. And then I got them into Paramount, and we did Bloodline and Almost Perfect Affair there. And I had pulled the tapes for Islands in the Stream because it was one of my favorite 70s Goldsmith scores, and I was desperate to get it out.
Why didn't that come together at Verez?
I pulled the tapes. I made myself a 15 IPS copy of it, which is why we were able to do what we did. And then it was going to cost too much.
Reuse fees, huh?
Yeah, which we don't have to worry about anymore. But in those days, they were huge. It would have cost, $30,000 or $40,000. It's a great movie and a great score, but nobody would never have sold enough to justify that money. And at that point, they weren't even, a blip on anybody's radar, really. I mean, they'd had a couple of hits, but not anything huge.
Well, it turned out to be fortunate that you pursued it, because I guess this was from an era when Paramount junked a lot of their music masters, or they weren't saving them?
I guess so, because we gave them back. They lost them, apparently, but in my closet, in every house I lived in, was this wonderful 15 IPS perfect tape, which I gave to Lucas Kendall to do, and I guess Bruce Botnick worked on it, but it sounded incredible. You didn't really have to do anything to it.
I got such a kick of seeing the Critzerland logo on the back cover.
That was funny, wasn't it?
Thank you. Now, you do have some, I believe, executive producer credits of Goldsmith albums on the Varese label. Did you have an involvement with some of those releases, like the, I think you're on the Flint Twofer or the Twofer of the Other and the Mephisto Waltz?
Yes, I brought those to Varese. Nick didn't really want to deal with them. And so Nick and I sort of teamed up on those so that he didn't have to deal with anybody but me. So I oversaw all those releases.
So you have only yourself to blame for not being able to release a complete The Other.
Yes. Who knew? I had no idea that Fox was giving this stuff in perpetuity. I couldn't believe it when I found out. And I only found that out 10 years ago. But it's mind-boggling, isn't it? You know?
It's mind-boggling to me that Varese hasn't taken advantage of expanding that gorgeous score, considering the tapes were already, you know, worked on by Mike Matacino for the Twilight Time Blu-ray isolated score track.
Exactly. It's just, well, it's what it is. And, you know, the original owner is not there anymore. And it's now in other hands who didn't predict that happening. And so who knows where it's going from here? Who knows where Concord is going to take it? I hope they take it to nice places.
And what was it like for you pursuing that score? Had you become familiar with it when the film was originally released?
Yeah, I saw it actually early on, before it was released. I saw a sneak preview of it, and I loved the book, and I loved the movie. Big fan of Robert Mulligan. And for me, it's one of Jerry's greatest scores, so that was one of the first things Nick and I talked about. So that was a really big thrill to be able to do at least that much of it. I wish we had the whole thing.
One day, hopefully. At least we've got that isolated track, but it's got some film edits and things in it. What I really like about it is it's so sweet and lovely, but it's just got this slight tinge of threat in it. You know, he really had a knack for nuances of feeling where there's just a little hint of something else mixed in.
He was a genius, you know, I mean, let's face it. There's that great sequence in The Other where he's flying. It's the flying sequence. It's brilliantly scored. And it keeps cutting to the kid who's going to die on the pitchfork. And the way he scores that is, it's one of the greatest sequences in the history of scoring, I think.
So it seems to me like you were responsible then for the bulk, if not all, of the classic Goldsmith score releases at Varese in the 90s, because I'm trying to think if there are any other. I think you were also involved in their Planet of the Apes.
Yes. Anything that came from Fox that wasn't new, except for, you know, I don't know. I don't remember when the Omen stuff came out. I didn't do any of that stuff, but it's all the ones with those covers. You know, they did those awful similar covers.
Right, the Fox series.
Yeah, the Fox series. But they were fun to work on and fun to get that stuff. I just wish they didn't own them. And we, you know, of course, Critchland was able to do in the last few years all of the Hermans that weren't owned in perpetuity we put out from the box.
Yeah, I had high hopes Varese was going to start reissuing theirs because I missed out on that box set. It sold out before it was even shipping. And they put out Journey to the Center of the Earth at 500 copies, and it sold out in a matter of hours. So I thought they'd continue with more at that number, and nothing so far.
One would hope, but, you know, I think they were in the middle of that sale and, you know, to Concord. So nobody knows where any of this is going.
Were there any other Goldsmith things that you worked on before starting Critzerland?
No, I just was his hugest fan.
Is he your favorite composer, period?
I don't think so.
Then you're not his hugest fan, I'm sorry to tell you.
Well, probably not. Because you look at his work, I became his hugest fan in the 60s with the TV stuff. But then, you know, you start with Lonely of the Brave and Freud. And I saw all these movies when they came out. And Adrian Messenger, I thought, was phenomenal. And any Goldsmith LP that came out, I had it the first day, Lilies of the Field and Patch of Blue was my favorite of them all back then. And that was an LP I had to buy 3 or 4 copies of because I played them every day for a year and a half. But everything, The Prize, and thank God we got that all complete with Lucas and Trouble with Angels. I loved them all, and I had them all that could be had, Sand Pebbles. But again, I saw every one of these movies in the theater as they came out. And even stuff like Sebastian, it was just so different than his other scores. And it was so, the guy knew how to write a theme. And, you know, of course, the film scoring changed, and then that was a shame. But then in the 70s, it was like we got a new Jerry, totally new Jerry. You know, Patton didn't sound like In Harm's Way or Von Ryan's. It didn't sound like anything. And then all his 70s scores were incredible, I thought. I mean, it's just you would sit there and go see movies and go, how can this be? How can one guy do this? So I was huge, you know, huge. I would go see movies just because he scored them. Capricorn 1 was a favorite. Coma was a favorite. And, you know, I put out, we were the first to put out Coma and Logan's Run on CD.
On Bay Cities, right?
On Bay Cities, yeah. So that was fun. And
So you did, there's your other Goldsmith involvement before Critzerland.
Then the 80s come. And, you know, I'm not going to be popular for saying any of this now, but I began to, again, see a new Jerry that I didn't like as much. So while there was The Poltergeist, which I thought was one of his greatest, there's also these other films that scores that start to get in there, Lonely Guy and Salamander, and where it's either repetitious or I'm just not responding to the music a lot. And then we get the 90s, Jerry, and I'm done, basically. And I know people hate me for saying that.
You put forward this crotchety persona on the boards, but I've seen you praise some of his 90s scores from time to time. So you're not consistent in your dislike. I know you like The Haunting, for example, and you would always champion it when other people would kind of dump on that score. And you'd say, oh, I've heard the complete thing, and it's actually wonderful.
No, I like The Haunting. I like Russia House. I like Sleeping with the Enemy. Matinee, I really liked. And the others, they're okay. There's nothing like horrible, you know, where I would go, oh, God, get that out of here. But, you know, I just, when he started getting into the very poundy stuff like Air Force One and, you know, the action-y stuff, I respond less to that, which is why I like The Haunting. But, you know, he's the guy, for me, is one of the top, probably in my top 5. I think Herman would probably be one, and Friedhofer would be in the top 5. And
Newman, I would expect.
Newman, I love, always loved, yeah. Ever, you know, because he did all those Fox movies that I loved when they came out, CinemaScope. You know, I love Elmer. I think Goldsmith took a leaf from Elmer in certain ways with certain scores.
A leaf?
A leaf, you know, from that book.
Oh, I see. It's funny you bring up Elmer Bernstein because for me, he's kind of the film composer most like Jerry out there because they worked similarly from the 50s. And of course, they died within weeks of each other. And they were both similarly prolific and versatile.
Well, you know, it was a different world. They were making so many more movies back when Elmer started, you know, because you had B features and C features and A features and double bills. And
Z features like Robot Monster.
Oh, yeah. And Elmer was incredible. I mean, Elmer, you know, some of my favorite scores ever written are Elmer. But I think they were like mirrors of each other in certain ways. So that Patch of Blue is a very similar feeling to To Kill a Mockingbird in terms of sensitivities and harmonics. And so they were both great. But I'll tell you, Jerry was... When you literally go to a movie because of the composer, you know that composer is something special. And it was just breathtaking what he did, I think. But I'll tell you something about all those guys who came up then. They really, in a way that composers don't today, unfortunately, because they're asked not to, they understood what a film score was. And a film score was not, oh, I'll write all this music and we'll lay it on top of the film and it'll be like pad, you know, where it's more sound design than music. They had such an understanding how to get under the spine of the film, on the skin of the film. They knew how to be the subtext for the characters or for the drama or for the, whatever, the comedy or whatever it was happening on the screen, so that the scores actually had a function. They were as important as the cast, in a way. Mm-hmm. And the story making and the filmmaking, you watch any Hitchcock Herman film and tell me how that film would be without that score. You can't do it.
Yeah. I think that's interesting, because a lot of those ones you were listing not liking as much, like Air Force One, that's not really a score that's about subtlety or subtext. It's a surface level composition, in my opinion. And that's probably what the film needed, and that's what it called for. But I don't think that there's like internal character struggle being expressed as much in that composition.
No, he gave them exactly what they wanted. They had a different score, as you know, and it probably didn't work. But it's just, I miss the days of film scores doing what a film score is supposed to do. And, you know, those guys on the message board will argue with you about that. Go, oh, it's so great today. Look at these guys.
Well, compared to what's coming out of Hollywood regularly today, Air Force One is
a masterpiece.
A masterpiece of composition. I'll be there day one when Verez puts out a complete release of it. But I can certainly understand where you're coming from in terms of what draws you to film music, you know, the subtlety and subtext that's going on. And I can see how certain of Jerry's 90s works are missing that, even if they're compositionally excellent. And, you know, he's still got his exciting mixed meter action writing and all of that stuff. But I see what you mean. And that does seem like a distinct change from anything he was doing from the 50s through probably the mid 80s, at least.
Because you didn't have directors who understood the point of music, and they all think, oh, I don't need music to make this work, or I just want, look, I have the Carmina Burana. Look how well this works. You know, give me that. And which is why we have so many Carmina Burana scores still to this day. And when you force composers to listen to other music, it's never going to lead to anything good, ever. You can listen to some scores today and you can say, okay, that's that. This is what they tempt this with. And it's just like, it's not interesting to me. You couldn't have the score to Planet of the Apes today. You could not have it.
No, you couldn't. I was amazed that Danny Elfman was able to write the score he did for the 2001 remake, because that was an atypical Hollywood score for the time. But certainly compared to Jerry's work, it wasn't as groundbreaking.
No, you couldn't have it. You could not. They would fire him instantly if he had done that score. But he wouldn't have written that score, because they would have played him some other score. And you couldn't have Psycho
right
today. Nobody would allow a score like that. And, you know, nobody told him what to write. Hitchcock was going to shelve the picture because he didn't think it worked. And Herman is the one who famously said, "Let me write the music. You're wrong." And, you know, it changed the film. I mean, because it did what it should do. It did what music is supposed to do. And today it's just laid on with a trowel. I don't mean to sound like an old fogey. And occasionally I'll hear something that's not terrible today, but oh my God.
I think that you're more likely now to find scores that are more creative on lower budget indie films or foreign films, just unexpected places. Sometimes, even in computer games and such, they're under the radar more, so the composers are given more creative free rein than they are allowed on big Hollywood blockbusters, which are investments on the part of the studios, and they just need to get their return on investment, and so they make safe choices for the most part. Safe choices usually translate as boring ones.
I think so, and, you know, there are certain composers, Philippe Rombi is,
of course.
You know, I'm a huge fan of his, and Joe Hisaishi, because they know how to write a tune, and they know what the tune is supposed to do.
It feels like film music is alive and well more in other countries than in Hollywood. You know, you go to Spain or you go to Japan, and there are still composers writing in that way that Hollywood used to, but largely does not anymore.
Yeah, and then they come to Hollywood and they get changed. They get the money and they have to do what they're told. I look at a composer like somebody recommended Roque Baños to me, and I like him a lot. You know, you watch his Spanish stuff and it's really good stuff. And then you watch his American stuff and you go, oh, they played him something.
Even composers who have been working in Hollywood for a long time, I don't want to put them down or anything, but it's rare for there to be a really striking and distinctive Danny Elfman or Patrick Doyle score like they used to write regularly. I'm not saying, I think they're just as talented as they ever were. And I think when they're given an opportunity, like I've heard samples of Danny Elfman's Violin Concerto and it's superb, at least the samples are, you know, when they get an opportunity to stretch their muscles, they can really deliver still. But I think they're oftentimes having to follow a temp track or, you know, encouraged to tone down their style.
Yes, because the business is run by morons and there's too many cooks in the kitchen. You know, there's too many cooks with the screenplays and the directors and the producers. I mean, you've got studio heads telling composers what to do. And you know, and this has been historically correct since they started throwing out scores, if a film is not landing correctly at screenings, if it's not landing, they don't blame the movie. They blame the composer first.
I think it's because it's a pass the buck thing, and how many things can you change at the last minute besides the music?
Yeah, you can't change the story. So they don't blame the director. They don't blame the writer. They blame the composer. Like, that's the problem, guys, with your terrible movie. And then they get a new score, and it's still a flop. So what is that? What lesson do you learn from them?
Yeah, it's so funny sometimes because the replacement score can bear a strong similarity to the rejected score. Like, I think of one of the most famous examples, Gabriel Yared's score to Troy, which is a very old-fashioned kind of orchestral score, but it gets replaced with a quickly composed James Horner one, which sounds, in my opinion, just as old-fashioned. I mean, it's quoting Russian classical composers left and right, especially Shostakovich. And it's like, what did they want? It feels like more of a political choice sometimes rather than an artistic one.
They want what they heard. They want, you know, the filmmaker shows it to the studio and everybody with a temp track. And everybody says, yeah. So you know what? License the tracks, which they do a lot. License those tracks. That's the score you want. If you're that big of a moron, yeah, go out with it and see what happens to you.
And sometimes that can work for a film. Like, I'm not one of those people who condemns Quentin Tarantino for his approach sometimes to dropping in things he just really likes. I'd rather that happen than a talented composer just be forced to imitate other composers and have something warmed over. Tarantino has a gift for that. Not everyone may do it as well.
Yeah, plus he has a sort of encyclopedic knowledge of the music he likes. So you're dealing with somebody who's a film nut.
And a film music nut, too.
Yeah.
So I guess I can associate with him.
I can associate with anybody who's a film music nut. I've been one my whole life. I'm the guy who would come out of movie theaters humming the score. You know, North by Northwest, I would hum that because none of it was available in any way, shape, or form. I saw the movie relentlessly and, you know, just come out humming that theme. And how can you hum a Bernard Herrmann theme? That's a feat in itself. But, you know, I would come out and go, dum ba da dum ba da dum ba.
I think that's still easier to hum than Alfred Newman's main title to Captain from Castile, which didn't stop me from trying many times as a kid to hum that.
Yeah, some movies are hummable. You didn't come out humming Psycho, certainly. But you can hum Patch of Blue, let me tell you.
Well, I'd like to hear you hum Planet of the Apes sometime. That would be an interesting experience.
Yeah, wouldn't it though? That was a genius. My God. You have no idea. You know, you tell people and you tell people, and there's no way to tell people what seeing a movie like that was like when it came out with that score. You know, it's just like, oh, really? Wow.
This is the guy who did A Patch of Blue? What?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you would never in a million years know that, be able to say that. I knew it because, you know, I followed his career. So he was one of a kind. He was absolutely one of a kind. But, you know, going back to today, I see movies. What was the movie about wine that Rolf Kent did? Sideways, was it called? You know, I go see that movie and everybody's like, Rolf Kent's score is amazing. I'm going, ooh, it's Klaus Ogerman. What are you talking about? And his main title is Take Five. You know, it's like you changed a few notes.
You expect the larger public to be familiar with Klaus Ogerman?
Absolutely.
Well, I know you've been making your efforts to get his music out there, and I do appreciate that. He didn't score any films, though, right?
He did, actually, in Germany. in the 50s, but he was like, I don't know how anybody didn't hire him because he was incredible. And, you know, I got to know him a little bit, which was fun in the Bay Cities days, and some nice letters from him. But, you know, anything I could do to get his music out, I would do. And he's incredible. If any, it's all film music. So, you know, if people want to take that chance and buy, you know, we just released one of his things that I had done on Bay Cities. It's just incredible. It all sounds like film music.
I got your Bay Cities copy years ago when I was working at Joel's Classical Shop, and I always liked it. So I was happy to see that get reissued for other people.
It's great. He's great. You know, but there's a lot of people who are great. There's a lot of, you know, listening to all this classical music, you hear where all this music comes from, of course, instantly. You know, I start listening to De Rosen Cavaliers waltzes, and I'm going, ah, the boys from Brazil.
So let's move on to your time after having founded Kritzerland Records. And it took quite a few years for you to come back around to Goldsmith again. How did that come about?
Well, not for want of trying. You know, it's the tentacles of other labels.
Reach far.
We could not get any Goldsmith. And I can't even remember what the first one was.
I think it was Breakheart Pass, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, I was doing a lot of MGM UA stuff at the time. And I knew it had been out twice. And then Jeff Bond called me and he said, you know, it's missing my favorite cue. And could you, is there any way? So I went and did the research and it was not on the tapes at all. But in those days, MGM UA had just started to let us pull other elements.
Right. So you got it from music stem, not music and effects, but.
Right. We got it from the music, the up and down music stem. And we were able to normalize it and make it sound good. And so Jeff got his favorite cue. And I think there was one other little 5-second thing that we put in. So that was nice to be able to do that, and it sold very well. And then we got Poltergeist. Was Poltergeist the next one? I don't remember.
I think Poltergeist 2, yeah.
And that was incredible to do.
I remember seeing on the Film Score Monthly board that MV of La La Land made a post, and he said they considered doing Poltergeist 2 but didn't think it was worth doing. You know, and I was like, what? And so I was really glad to see you step in.
I stepped in because I listened to all the other releases.
And it was a sound quality consideration.
They were all hateable for different reasons. And I don't mean to take anything away from the people who did them. They just weren't things that I enjoyed listening to. And therefore, I never listened to the score, ever.
I had the exact same experience until your Kritzerland release.
Yeah. And so I decided that I would look at it and see what they had. And when I found out they had the analogs, masters of it, that's when I decided to do it, because I was not interested in working from the digital tapes. And what nobody understands, I think we put it in the notes, is it was recorded digitally and analog at the same time. They're both first generation tapes. And for some reason, everybody said, oh, digital. Well, it was very early digital, first of all. And second of all, the analog sounded better. It sounded like music all of a sudden instead of harsh. And it was on 3 tracks, so there wasn't a lot of mixing to be done or anything like that. The analog gave it a warmth that it didn't have before. It just was like hearing a whole different score. And we rebalanced the choir, which was all recorded separately. You know, it was all Bruce Botnick. I mean, it's not like he didn't do all this stuff. Thank you. But the analog just had everything I wanted. And we worked for a really long time. And I wanted to make sure we got every version of every, so that nobody could say we didn't have everything.
And then Entrada followed up your release and they found an alternate of something that on the digital tapes, I guess.
Who cares?
I found it interesting to discover.
And, you know, I'm glad it's out there for people. You know, it's just, I can't, this thing about releasing things 5-6 times, I just can't.
Yeah, I guess it's what the market will bear, but it is kind of funny. Of all things to get released so many times, Poltergeist 2. While other Jerry Goldsmith scores that are maybe more high profile have only been released once and are long out of print.
I know. So what else did we do? Is it just the two scores?
I think the next score you worked on was Alien Nation.
Oh, yeah. Alien Nation. That was my, yes. I did it not so much for the Goldsmith, but for the other guy who was such a nice fellow. Kurt Sobel.
And there are comparatively few releases of his music as well.
There are. I have a lot of them because he gave me a ton of stuff. And he's really good. He's very, very, very talented.
Yeah, it was interesting to be able to compare those two.
They are interesting. I don't think either one of them are great in the film, but it's interesting. And was there one other that I did?
Rio Conchos. That is the most dramatic sound restoration, I think, of all.
Well, that's Mike. You know, he's a Brit at that stuff. A lot of the Fox stuff that we've done where other releases existed are so much better. If people don't understand that, they really ought to.
Yeah, two that stand out for me are Newman's David and Bathsheba and Friedhof, my favorite Friedhofer score, actually, which is The Reigns of Ranchiper.
Yes, that was incredible upgrades.
I got to say, between those three releases, those two and Rio Conchos, you really had my hopes up that 100 Rifles could be made to sound drastically better. And I'm sure Mike did the best he could with it, but it wasn't as severe of an upgrade as Rio Conchos was.
No, it all depends on what they got. You know, sometimes we luck out, sometimes we don't. It's great. You know, some of the Hermans had major upgrades. It's wonderful to be able to have spectacular upgrades. Man Called Peter is a nice upgrade, the one we just announced. When we can, we do. But we have, I think people will enjoy some of the stuff that's coming next year. It's just been very slow. You know, I pulled back about 3 years ago. I was so tired of the glut of releases that I did something radical for us, and I just sort of pulled back from, we were 24 titles a year and 2 a month. And I pulled back to much less than that, you know, maybe 16 or 18 titles, and then I pulled back to even less.
That was sad for me because I supported you in that Indiegogo campaign of yours, and I thought that would lead to maybe more, but not that I, you know, have the budget to keep up with more releases, but I was, you know, really enjoying a lot of your releases, and it seemed like they slowed down a lot.
They slowed down, not because of the Indiegogo. It's because I got in, I thought I was in at Universal, and then they just stopped communicating the guy. I don't I tried to go around him. I tried to get in there in other ways. We may eventually be in there starting this year, next year, but I don't know that for a fact. But I asked for three or four things there. I got a lot of stuff locked up at Rhino, like 19 titles. That's where, that was going to be our huge thing. And the first of them, which was Ode to Billy Joe, took almost a year to get approved. I mean, the Rhino part of it was approved within 2 weeks. And then the artwork sat on somebody's desk for a year.
Oh, I see. And that was without you even trying to license additional music to add on.
Correct. That was the deal. We were just doing the album. And in the old Rhino days, you could just do that and nobody had to approve anything except Rhino. But that changed. And I told him, I said, I'll be dead by the time we get these 16 releases done, or too old to care. So, we still have them locked up. And apparently now something is about to shift where we won't have to go through that. If we do only what was on the original album, I would be able to write new notes, but all the pictures and the back of the album, everything has to be exactly what the LP was. So I'm going to try one that way and see how fast we can do it.
What about at Fox? Are you able to say what the situation is there? Are you going to be able to continue mining those vaults, or with the Disney purchase, is that going to change?
Nobody really has a clear answer on that, so we're trying to do as much as we can. So the multi-disc set that's coming out is one of the director sets, like we did Preminger and Fuller at Fox. It's one of those. And then beyond that, we'll just see. We'll do as many as we can. And every label has been told that you better do them now because we don't know what's happening. But I tried to get into Disney, which you would think I would be able to get into. I have many, many contacts there. And that has not panned out yet. And but there's always stuff that shows up that's a surprise. I stopped with MGM UA because I didn't want to keep repeating, and I had done everything I wanted to do there. I mean, we did 70 or 80 MGM UA titles.
I'm bummed that you didn't want to do Support Your Local Sheriff, I have to say.
I can't remember what the story was, whether what was there wasn't good enough. I don't remember.
That was good enough for the isolated score release on the Blu-ray, at least.
Yeah, exactly. But frequently, everybody gets excited about that. But when you really isolate it as a listening experience, it's not that good. And you just don't want to do it. I was very keen to do another place I've been trying to get in is Sony, not the record company, but the studio. And I really wanted to do Experiment and Terror. And I said to Mike, I said, well, the isolated score sounds great. He goes, no, I'm going to give you a copy of it. And he did, and it was terrible. He couldn't release that. Some people would release it, but I wouldn't. I think people have come to know that I do what I like. So, when I know the score to Red isn't going to sell any copies, I do it because I loved Soren Hilgard, and he died. So to me, that's something I needed to do for him.
In the wake of Film Score Monthly shutting down, you seem one of the strongest remaining film music producers who sticks to the fool's errands, releasing the really obscure things that other people would not touch. And I appreciate that about you, that you have that Lucas Kendall quality where you're going to put out that Gary McFarlane score, something totally obscure and under the radar just because you believe in the quality of the material.
I tried to get us into re-recording last year. And unfortunately, the score I want to re-record would be hugely expensive and never, ever make its money back. So I sort of...
Do you mind me asking what it is?
I cannot say, but it would be so expensive because it requires total takedown. There's no music available. So John Morgan would have had to sit for 6 months and take down every cue. And there's a choir and a thing. It's from the 50s. It's a score everybody would want. And, well, probably my favorite sci-fi score. It just became, it was going to cost $70,000 or $80,000 to do, and you're not going to sell enough to ever.
You could always try a Kickstarter. What do you have to lose?
We were going to do that. That was the plan. But it was just, he just thought it was going to be too much work. But it was a lot more money than Dial-M was, or Brideboard Black, I have to assume, which I just heard yesterday.
Are there any other Goldsmith titles you're interested in tackling at any point in the future?
Anything that hasn't been released. Anything.
Oh, in that case, I'd like to interest you in Lorinda Almeida's contemporary creations for the Spanish guitar, which has an early Goldsmith concert work on it. You should check that out on EMI.
I've had that album when I was young.
Excellent.
A few things. I would do it in a second. And maybe we will.
We could really use a good sounding one. And you're one of the few film music labels that still considers concert hall music.
Yep, I do.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. And I'll let you go, but I hope you may return sometime and talk to us more about your other Goldsmith releases that may come out in the future.
Anytime.
I appreciate it. Take care.
Bye-bye.